brings a lot of hope for the future with some of the things that we are dealing with that I think that will slowly not be an issue or not in the same level as it is now because of people being exposed to the abilities that women or people from different backgrounds have, but not limited because we haven't seen it or we haven't elevated in the way as a society that we should have.
That was Dr. Nya Blair Hackworth, Director of Inclusion at the NCAA, talking about how she uses her role to help students, faculty, and staff of colleges and universities increase inclusion and belonging for the best possible outcomes. And this is IBJ's The Freedom Forum with Angela B. Freeman. Dr. Hackworth, welcome to the Freedom Forum. As we're not far removed from March Madness, which was just outstanding this year, you appreciate that 2024 has been and will continue to be a huge year for sports in Indianapolis. As such, I've been speaking with some of the forces behind some of the major sports organizations in our city, like the NCAA. However, before we get started, will you please tell our listeners a bit about you, your educational and professional background, and any other factors that have led to you becoming the Director of Inclusion at the NCAA?
First, thank you for having me on. I really appreciate being here today. Again, my name is Dr. Nya Blair Hackworth. My pronouns are she and her. I'm a Southerner living this Midwest life. I have a 17-year experience in diversity, equity, and inclusion and belonging work. Most of my career, I worked on college campuses, the leading, supporting the work, as well as other aspects of leadership development for students and faculty and staff. In addition, thinking about my background, I'm from Arkansas. I went to school at the University of Central Arkansas for my bachelor's degree, which was in English and minored in African American Studies. I did my master's degree at the University of Arkansas, where my degree was in higher education with an emphasis in student affairs. And it's been about a year now that I completed my doctoral degree at Abilene Christian University in organizational leadership. So again, having worked on college campuses, supporting students, supporting faculty and staff, and I think it was in 2014, I realized that I wanted to look at a career change, still doing diversity, equity, inclusion work, but wanted to look to see if it was in a different sector or a different area. And I heard about this wonderful opportunity at the NCAA in the Office of Inclusion from a mentor, and I decided to apply, and from there, you know, was able to get the job and been working here for about 4.5 years now, supporting not only our student athletes. We have over 500,000 student athletes at 1,100 member institutions, but also supporting our national office staff, which is close to 500 staff in the aspects of diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging at the national office.
Well, that's a fantastic and fascinating history and career progression. And similar to Dr. Allison Barber, who was just here last month, you have that academic and professional background in education, right? You talked about getting at least a couple degrees in education. However, unlike Dr. Barber, who was a teacher, I don't think you spent a lot of time teaching, right? It seems like you've spent more time on the administrative side of higher education. And so I want to talk about that a little bit, because oftentimes when we talk about academic careers, we think about the professorial career path, right? And not the administrators. But there is a full career path in higher ed administration. So can you tell us a bit about that?
I learned about that path when I was an undergraduate from a mentor who said, hey, have you ever thought about working on a college campus? And I never thought about that. And so getting my master's degree in higher education with an emphasis in student affairs really exposed me to the career opportunities within the administration route. I've had the opportunity to work at 4 institutions of higher education and working in different capacities. I started out working in a career at LSU, overseeing what was then called the African American Culture Center, which they still have that here today, and being able to support not only students, but administrators through trainings and programmatic aspects of the work. Then I left there and was able to go to an assistant dean role, where I not only supported students, particularly students of color, but also non-traditional students in doing that work to support them and their families. And then one of them, I think my career highlights was working at the University of Houston, where I was able to be the first director of what was then their Center for Diversity and Inclusion, where I was able to hire staff and we were able to create initiatives and programs for the campus. And again, a lot of times when you think about the administration route, sometimes it's focused just on students and sometimes it's focused on students, faculty, and staff. And thankfully, I had the opportunity to work with all three populations. And I think that those positions most definitely prepared me to work at the NCAA and had a lot of transferable skills. But it's definitely different working on a college campus versus working in, even though the NCAA is not a corporation, but a more of a corporate feel as compared to being on campus day in and day out.
I appreciate when I was in college, I don't remember the terms diversity, equity, and inclusion at all, but I certainly remember having a multicultural center. I certainly remember me as a Black student, a Black female student, doing a lot of events and things at that multicultural center. And I know you also started off at some capacity at the multicultural center, right?
Well, it was called even Minority Service. When I was an undergrad student, it was called Minority Services. And then it went to the multicultural center at another institution.
Yeah. So my question is, you know, how did those roles, you talked about some of the transferable skills that you gleaned from some of that you're now able to apply at your role at the NCAA. But how did those roles at the multiple institutions that you talked about in which you worked help navigate you to that multicultural DE&I piece at the college level as compared to focusing more on potentially the faculty or the administrators, et cetera?
The work has evolved from the name, as we just said, right, from multicultural to inclusion to diversity, equity, inclusion, belonging now. And so one, being able to keep up with the times and the literature and the research of how the work was evolving and even who the work is for, quote unquote, because I remember in undergrad, in Minority Services, they were only really looking at Black students. And so it was very like kind of Black and white, the work. And then it started expanding to support Hispanic students. And that was, again, at that particular institution. But one, evolving, not only as a professional, but making sure that I'm evolving in the work and as myself as I'm growing the skill set to not only speak the language, but to understand who the work is for. And really now, when you think about diversity, equity, inclusion, belonging, that work is for everybody. And it involves everyone's responsibility. Back years ago, you only looked at it, particularly on a college campus, that was just for the diversity office, the minority services office, people for them to focus on. And now when we think about the work, everyone has a shared responsibility to help form sense of belongings and help people feel valued and supported and appreciated for who they are.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was just talking to my firm diversity partner, and she was speaking on a panel and said the exact same thing. This is not my job. I'm just leading this effort. The job is all of us, right? And it becomes much more of a initiative to involve everyone at the organization, at the corporation, to not just buy into these values, but to also personify those values and implement them on a day-to-day basis. So as you've evolved in your multiple institutions, your career in higher ed administration, going kind of back to the academic focus, you know, I appreciated in talking with not just on this show, but others, or should I say in other capacities, women who are in academic, kind of more professorial lineage as far as career advancement, et cetera. And I appreciate that particularly women and minority women or diverse women have their own set of challenges and barriers in that kind of academic career path as compared to, you know, the more corporate career path. Although many of the issues and challenges and barriers are similar, they may present differently in the academic setting versus a corporate setting. So I'd like to know, you know, what have been some of the challenges or barriers that you may have face in your career progression on the higher ed side, if any, and what should others interested in academic administration know about the career versus the career progression provided, again, to kind of the academic professors and that kind of tenure track as compared to administration?
So as you just said, when you're a professor, you have that tenure track process that you can go to help give you that job security. Whereas within administration, that is not the case. And some of the challenges that I faced, particularly working on college campuses, that again are similar to those who even in the professor role faces, one of people not recognizing the value that you bring to the organization or to the department, not only based off of your education, but your work experience and your skill set, and really having to advocate for yourself, be it for your department to have more resources or for you to be considered for certain roles or positions. Those are things that I've had to navigate, and I've had to also help people to understand the challenges of DEIB work. Again, that's what we call it now, diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging work. But there have always been challenges with not the work itself, but people understanding the value and the importance that the work brings. And when you are, in my experience, a woman, particularly a Black woman, being able to lead these efforts or even support these efforts and advocating for that, sometimes that has been minimized. The work has been minimized. And so really being strategic with not only how you do the work and who you partner with, but also how you get others to understand the value that it brings. And on college campus, you know, a lot of times it goes to supporting the students, which is true, but also thinking about how does that infiltrate into the classroom experience and the overall recruitment and retaining of students in your institutions. And so I definitely know that that has kind of shifted, particularly now when you think about state laws that are impacting, when you think about even just, I think, post the murder of George Floyd. You know, there's a lot of things that have shifted, some for the positive in terms of people understanding the value, but also there's still work to be done. And so those, I think, were some of the biggest challenges or barriers that I faced working on college campuses and administration.
I can absolutely appreciate the added burden of showing value in a higher ed college campus setting for DE&I as compared to the corporate space. Because, you know, I remember back in the day when I was at Lilly, we were making the business case for diversity, right? And that business case for larger corporate America has been made in the statistics that show, the data that shows that you get better outcomes, you get better value, you get better investments, you get better decision making. Like, I think that business case has generally been made, but most of that is tied to some corporate bottom line or some corporate metric that's being measured, right? I appreciate that that may be more challenging in a higher ed setting where it's not about necessarily driving dollars. It's not necessarily about profitability, but it's about students. It's about the expanded diversity of students, the number of students, the diverse backgrounds of students, et cetera, and their success after graduation, right? I'm sure that's right. A major metric for assessing whether a college has been successful or not. So as you have had these experiences and roles in leading teams at the higher ed capacity, what have you found to be particular strengths that you bring to your teams? How have you personally navigated your own authenticity in the workspace? We talk a lot, particularly in DE&I, right, work about authenticity and being able to be your authentic self. I want to know how you've been able to personally navigate that in your workplace, among your leadership ranks, in a way that also allows your peers, colleagues, employees, and others, and the students, quite frankly, to feel that same freedom and know that their authenticity is actually valued, not just by your institution or whatever institution they may be at, but by the greater corporate America that they may be entering after graduation.
So I'll start first with the question about the skill set that, like, I've been able to bring to teams in different workplaces. And one, I feel like I'm really good, and I am really good at being able to recognize the strengths and talents in others and help position them or put them in roles or in them tasks that really hone and bring those things out. So I really like to speak to and get to know and to learn different aspects about people that I'm working with or team members to be able to, again, it's like when you're working on a team, putting a puzzle together, right? We all have a role that we serve to making that puzzle complete. And I really enjoy and I have found success in being able to put people in different positions or assign them different tasks that really bring out their skill set. And also, that kind of goes with strategic. We've been very strategic, particularly when you think about doing DEI work, you have to think about it in multiple ways and being able to, even though in hired, as you said, it's not a bottom line in terms of cost per se, but being able to say how the work connects to other aspects of campus and how this department brings not only significance to the overall unit, but to the university as well. And so being strategic. And then lastly, futuristic. So I remember when I was at the University of Houston in about, I think it was 2015, and we were, the team and I were coming up with a way to engage staff and students in DEI. And we talked about belonging. And that was before belonging really became mainstream. And so really thinking about ways to bring people in, because a lot of times, and particularly now, DEI has become very polarizing. And so how do you help bring people in and plant seeds? And so being futuristic, I think, and strategic really has helped me in those aspects.
So can we talk about that just a little bit? Because we just had, again, I was just at a panel where they were talking about the fact that DE&I is currently under attack. It's being put up on the shelf. That's not needed anymore. When you are doing the work, right, when you are in a position of leadership at any institution that is tasked with doing this work, and it's already mentally and emotionally challenging and taxing at times when the buy-in is there, right? We saw after George Floyd, mass buy-in for the reality that DE&I is important. It should be implemented on a broader scale. And now that's getting rolled back. How is it for you and others in these roles in trying to continue to push forward with the work and making sure we evolve and progress in a climate where all intents and purposes says we should be kind of rolling these things back?
One thing one of my mentors helped me realize is that this is not anything new in terms of people not always seeing the value in the work. And so keeping the main thing, which is the work. And I think also staying true to my why. Why did I want to have a career in this work? Why am I moving forward in these particular ways? What's the ultimate goal? And it is frustrating. It's tiring. It's lonely. But being able to go back to the why and remember like the main thing is the main thing has really helped me. And being able to also talk to my colleagues and peers who are leading and doing this work, and we're able to have a level of understanding about how taxing it can be, but also how rewarding it can be to be able to encourage each other. Those are some things that have been very helpful. And then sometimes taking a step back, just pausing for a minute too, because like you said, when the murder of George Floyd, you know, people were really reaching out and wanting to do a lot of things. I have a diversity consulting business, 184 Ross Coaching and Consulting, and I received a lot of people reaching out to say, can you do a training? Can you help us? Can you come talk? And it was like, oh, great. The people are realizing this. But I remember asking a friend, I think it was the summer of 2021, to say, I wonder what's going to happen in 3 or 4 years.
Right, right. How long is this wave going to last?
Yeah. Right. And it's so sad to know that like it hasn't, you know, it was just a moment versus a real movement. I am hopeful that we get back to that in that DEIB work. It has, again, it has continued to evolve. And the murder of George Floyd were really honed in on the inequities, particularly from a racial and ethnic perspective, or we think about the pandemic and the different challenges or things that were used against the Asian population. And there continues to be other minoritized populations that are affected in different ways. And so we have to continue to be a voice and help bring people along and help people understand that regardless of laws, regardless of people's negative viewpoint, that we all have a responsibility to make people feel welcome and supported to be their authentic self, right? And you asked the question about authenticity. When I started my career, that was one of those conversations about being your authentic self and what does that look like? And so I will say I've had a challenge as I have in my younger years of like being able to feel like I can show up as my authentic self. I didn't think about it in that particular way. I had people that I looked up to and I admired and I said, oh, I need to be able to function and to do things in these particular ways. And not that I was being fake, but I also understood that, but also understood what it took to be in different work environment places. And some people call it code switching and different things like that. And then here the last few years, the conversation more about authentic self. And when you have team members or employees who are younger generation, they really They want to be in spaces where they can't be their authentic selves. And I had to learn, like, how am I modeling that? And it may seem simple to some, but I recall being in Houston and I would not get my hair braided until it was certain times of the semester, till the students were leaving, or to the summer when I didn't have a lot of meetings or presentations. And I told myself, I'm like, not yet. How you wear your hair does not determine how successful you are, your talents and your strengths. But I felt like I had to prove myself first before I could do that. And once I started changing my mindset, then I gave permission, you know, not physically, but, you know, I was able to give, quote unquote, like permission to other people who looked like me or who didn't look like me to be able to be their authentic self. And I continue to hopefully in my current role to do that, and recognizing that it's still also a challenge, but I am more comfortable in my skin and who I am. And that has definitely helped me. And I also think that having other team members who lead with that first to the younger generation, they have also helped me to say, like, yes, like, it's okay to come into work with my hair with braids, or, you know, being able to speak up for myself and not being worried about someone saying that I'm being aggressive, or because I'm not smiling, you know, I'm mean. It's like, no, like, I can combat these negative perceptions to say, this is who I am. And this does not dictate how I do my work, how successful I am in the role, how I can form community with others.
We often talk about representation and the need for representation, particularly at the higher levels, the executive level, C-suite levels, such that, you know, your employees, the people that work in any organization can see that there is possibility. There is an opportunity for someone who may look differently or come from a different background or different heritage to be in those spaces. But you just made a really good point. It's not just representation to signify that you can get to that space. It's also representation as a mechanism to model that you can be your authentic self and still make it to those spaces,
right,
and places, right?
Right. Right.
Not just for the diversity numbers at that space, which is very important and there should be representation, but also for the people who are coming behind to see that not only there is someone of color or a woman or whatever the case may be at that level, but they are able to also be their authentic self and not have to be a completely different person at that level.
Sure, right? Right. And I've been very, you know, blessed in different roles to be able to see that from senior leaders who look like me. I remember at one place of employment, there was the managing director, I think, of our HR, who had wore braids. And I sent a message, I'm like, oh, you're rocking those braids. And so thank you for even wearing that, because that perception used to be that, hey, you couldn't wear your hair particularly like this if you were in a particular role. Or, you know, my current senior vice president in our unit, she is very authentic into who she is and her background and her experiences, being from a Southern woman to being a woman of faith, and doing so in a way that doesn't alienate people, but invites people in, because they get to know who she really is. And like you said, it's important to be able to model that, but to see that too. And it's like, oh, I can kind of like let my guard down in a sense.
Those things are very important. So again, contrary to typical academic settings, I certainly appreciate that D&I work often requires you or anyone in that space doing that work to teach and educate folks that often don't necessarily want to be educated in the space that you're teaching, right? It's not your typical academic or higher ed setting where people have signed up, they've paid tuition to come get taught whatever it is that's being taught. Oftentimes, these things are being rolled out in ERGs or corporate settings or doing trainings, and everybody's not, I mean, we fully know everybody's not yet bought in. If it was, there would be no need for the Freedom Forum. There would be no need for a D&I director or, you know, diversity of inclusion director or such. So I guess what I would ask is, you may be challenged with teaching and educating people in areas and spaces that they haven't necessarily signed up for, they haven't necessarily bought into. And you talked about some of those transferable skills that you had gleaned earlier. I guess my question is, what transferable skills have you obtained during your time over the course of your career that you feel like you've utilized, particularly in your inclusion role now at the NTAA? And also importantly, what have you learned about yourself in this time of being in this space, leading DEI, particularly at the NTAA?
So I think that when you're working and supporting individuals who may not see the same value in DEI, be it on a college campus, corporate, even in your community spaces, what I've realized, and I realized this probably about 7 or 8 years ago, is that I'm planting seeds. So I can't take the full responsibility of why a person does not see the value in the same way or at all in whatever aspect that I may be talking about or providing workshop or some type of educational experience. But what I hope to do is to plant a seed to help change a mindset. And maybe I hadn't planted a seed, but maybe I'm watering a seed that someone else planted. And so that leaves that takes some of the responsibility off of me, because especially early on in my career, I feel like I just go and change the world. You know, and there was so much to do, and there still is so much to do. But I also realized that we all have a role to play in that. And a part of diversity and inclusion is that we don't all think the same. And so you have to remember that as well, because our backgrounds, our experiences, who we engage with, what we look into or watch on TV or social media, those all things impact us and how we view the world. And so however much time that I have with a person or with individuals, my role is to plant a seed and to do it hopefully in a way that is welcoming. Because again, there's already a lot of divisiveness that's going on. And I hope for the best from
you. Yeah. I mean, that's all you really can do, right? That's your touch point, and then whatever happens after the fact. Now it's time for a quick break.
Get caught up on the state's top business news every business day with the Inside Indiana Business Radio On Demand podcast. Available now at InsideIndianaBusiness.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back with Dr. Nya Blair Hackworth, Director of Inclusion at the NTAA, on this April episode of the Freedom Forum with Angela B. Freeman. So you talked about the sentiment and the ability for people to really embrace DEI, particularly around George Floyd, and how that has kind of chilled a bit and even gotten a bit cold. I've recently heard, and I didn't appreciate this, and I'm not a DEI professional like you, but I try to stay close to it and appreciate what's going on. And I recently saw this social media meme that said DEI actually stands for or represents didn't earn it, right? Which I had never heard that. Didn't earn it. And it struck me because I have heard so many times from non-diverse people how the word privilege really triggers them. They don't like privilege because it implies that whatever successes they've had, they didn't earn it. But yet that same sentiment's being applied to DEI, which for me, I think I have the same reaction to that many non-diverse people have to the term privilege. And so I wonder, how do you reconcile, if at all, any consistent thinking between non-diverse people who believe that anyone from benefits from DEI didn't earn it, but can't appreciate the unearned privilege that they also may benefit from, even though they don't like the term privilege?
We all have some level of privilege, right? And it may be privilege that we're thinking about getting up, being able to walk or go to our jobs or employments or schools or whatever the case may be. We have different levels of privilege. And so it is disheartening when a person does not realize that the unearned privileges that they have just because of their racial background or their gender or their sexual orientation, and the list can go on and on. And so one, helping people to see that and not be so defensive toward it, because I think that sometimes people are like, oh, when this person has it, then that leaves me out. But one, there should be room for all of us to be able to have whatever opportunities we need. But when we come thinking about things from like an equity standpoint, because some of us don't have the certain privilege, we're not born in that, then there needs to be things to be able to provide for other people. But that does not mean that because this person received a scholarship or was able to get in, that they didn't work for it. Or when people talk about hiring, I remember being on college campus and I'd be a part of search committees and they said, well, we want to hire the best candidate, a qualified candidate. Of course you want a qualified candidate. And of course you want the best candidate. And you should consider the diverse representation of your pool, right? Or you should consider your search committee and making sure that they're representing various aspects of who you'd want to see in a role, right? And so those things are not mutually exclusive. And so those are some of the things that I've shared with individuals who kind of come with that perspective, because I think that it's unfair and it's unwarranted.
And that's so real. I mean, you just touched on something that I've seen and multiple lawyers in the legal profession have seen, because it is very prevalent in the legal capacity, which is that sentiment, that bias view that often unsaid, that when you begin diversifying the candidate pool, you automatically have lowered the bar of excellence, right? And that's not always said, but it's absolutely implied that, oh, shoot, now we're going to interview this Black woman. That automatically means we're not looking for the same standard of excellence or qualifications that we were when we were considering this white woman. And so I appreciate you stating that, because it should not be an assumption, and it can't be overstated that simply considering diverse candidates does not in any way mean that you are somehow lowering the bar of expertise, qualifications, exceptionalism that you expect from any candidate, right? And I can say, as a diverse woman, I know that to be true, because I'm as hard on our diverse folks as I am on the non-diverse folks, right? If you're coming in my law firm and you're interviewing, you absolutely are going to have to be as well, if not better, because that's just the nature of the game. And regardless of how or why you got hired, there are going to be people who just assume that you got here because you're a Black woman or you're a LGBTQ plus man or whatever the case may be. It can't possibly be, because you're just excellent at what you do. So I appreciate you highlighting that, because those are some of the things that aren't always talked about, but it's the kind of the biases that we carry, again, aren't necessarily said, but they play themselves out in candidate committees and such. It's also one of the reasons why such candidate committees, when you're looking for a new candidate or you're looking for students to admit, also should be diverse, so that they appreciate that diversity should be part of this process, even though we all appreciate we're looking for excellence.
And when you don't do that, that's how microaggressions happen.
That's right.
Before the person hired or when the person is hired. I mean, it impacts how long people stay at
companies.
Or how long a student stays on a campus. So again, if we don't get to the root of the things, then it has these other impacts that sometimes are seen or felt in small ways.
Yeah, because just hiring that person doesn't change your culture, right? So I've even started using language to make that clear: qualified, diverse person. So people make it clear that doesn't mean, because we're looking at a diverse person, we're lowering our expectations of qualifications or exceptionalism. But in any capacity, any organization, when that person actually is hired, they are going to be exposed to the culture. And if that culture does not lend itself to them being able to excel, them being able to win, I've said, and even in my legal capacity, as soon as a woman or a diverse person really appreciates that they cannot win, it's time to go. I mean, once you really know that, okay, it makes no difference how good my brief is, or it makes no difference that I just led this argument, I'm still not going to get the opportunity to do X. I'm still not going to get the opportunity to do Y. It makes no difference. That's when people start leaving, because they appreciate the culture is what it is. And I think people, I mean, you've got to be a Gen Xer. I'm a Gen Xer. I think Gen X and before kind of took on the vantage point of, I'm going to change the culture. You know, I'm going to show them I'm excellent and I'm going to change the culture. And quite frankly, I think this younger generation they don't care about changing
your culture.
Either.
Like, hey, it is what it is.
That's right. And I don't fit, and I'll go find someplace that does. They have no interest in trying to stick around and trying to convince, you know, us, the Gen X and boomers and all the old people, that y'all should be doing things differently and y'all should really be on the ball. They don't care about that. They are going to the next place. So I think there has to be some appreciation for people who do come into an organization. I mentor people that you have to lead with excellence first. You can't come in knocking down the door and telling people how all their culture and everything needs to change. You first have to show competency.
Right.
You have to show excellence, have to show value. But when you do that, there really is a mechanism to begin to change the culture in a way that will benefit not just you, but people coming after you.
Yeah, that's such a great point, because you're so right. People come in and they're like, oh, I don't like how this is. This needs to be different. It's like, focus on your job.
That's
focus
right.
on what you're doing, how you're doing, how you can improve. And I've had an experience where I've left institutions where it took me a while to realize, it was like, okay, my value is not seen here. My value is not appreciated in the way in which I want it to be. Because sometimes people are like, well, we appreciate you. We, you know, did this and this. But what did you do? Did you listen to what I need? Did you provide me opportunities to excel? And then I've said, okay, once I've come to that realization after trying to make the changes,
that's
after
right.
sticking around, after saying, oh, let's just give it another try. I can see them doing this and that. I then had to say, okay, let's move on to something else now.
Yeah. I can't. I'm not going to change the culture, and not in a time frame that makes sense for me.
Right.
Let's talk about, you know, some of the things that are happening in the city as it relates to the NCAA, and particularly, you know, again, I started off our conversation say we just finished up. Awesome March Madness. It was off the chain. Women made history with all the viewers and the sponsorships and the engagement. Of course, Purdue was in the house, so Indiana was totally on board. And so following all the excitement of having, you know, Purdue and Zach Edey and the whole crew, along with Caitlin Clark of Iowa, you know, in the national championships, along with, and I got to give shout out to the undefeated women of South Carolina and the Huskies of UConn, who just really made it an exciting national championship. What do you think will be the impact at the college level of having, and even specifically here in Indianapolis and nationally, of having players like Zach Edey and Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese and Cordoza and so many of the college level who really got on the national stage in a way that many pro players haven't gotten, with the attention, with the sponsorships, with the engagement? What do you think will be the future impact of that, and how will that begin to impact some of the younger players that are coming in as we go forward at the collegiate level?
How it's going to impact younger players, and I think that we're already seeing it, younger fans, like younger girls being able to realize that, like, hey, I can play ball in college and I can do really well. And not that that wasn't already the case, but I think that it's expanded it to even more. And not just for younger girls, you know, younger boys being able to see that, hey, girls are just as talented and can contribute and play hard, you know.
Yeah.
So it's really exciting to see. And it was definitely exciting to be at some of those games, too.
Yeah.
And when you think about the Indianapolis community, I mean, the draft going on, like, I think it's going to be incredible. I think that with this new generation of players and how they're coming out, I think that this is going to continue to elevate women's basketball and women's sports in general. And I'm just happy to live in a town where we might get the number one draft pick.
Yes, yeah. I'm so excited about it. And, you know, to your point, you talk about all the little girls, and no question, there was a gazillion little girls with Caitlin Clark's number and waiting. But I actually watched a news episode that was talking about all the little boys and all the little boys like waiting to get her autograph and see her. And I think that in and of itself, when we talk about diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging work, just generations of young men seeing the power, the impact of women, that in and of itself changes the mindset with regard to D&I. Those young boys who are standing waiting to get Caitlin Clark's autograph will not grow up thinking that, oh, I can't have a woman on my executive team because, oh my goodness. That in and of itself shifts the mindset for generations to come. So seeing seeing that kind of inclusion is really, really exciting.
It is. I have a nephew who's 10 years old and he plays basketball. And when he would see Caitlin shoot those 3 points, he's like, oh, look at her. She like, he was just so amazed that she could keep shooting 3-point shots. And I'm like, yeah, Jackson, like you don't have to just be a guy to shoot 3-pointers. Yeah. Right. And so, like you said, it's going to change, it brings a lot of hope for the future with some of the things that we are dealing with that I think that will slowly not be an issue or not in the same level as it is now because of people being exposed to the abilities that women or people from different backgrounds have, but not limited because we haven't seen it or we haven't elevated in the way as a society that we should have.
Yeah, and that's happening now. Like, I have a 19-year-old who's played basketball his whole life, watched his mom switch careers from science to law, has female friends and colleagues who he's supported in sports his whole life. So just the mindset around gender equity is very, very different from this generation, you know, post, like, I don't even know what that is, Z's or post-Z, like, I don't even know what's after Z. But, like, the generations that are coming up already think differently, so much differently about gender equity, about racial equity, social injustice. Like, they are so much more diverse in and of themselves that the issues that we're fussing about and going back and forth about now seem kind of non-issue to those generations. They're more worried about the things we need to be worried about, like climate control,
right?
And gun control,
right?
And, you know, those kind of things. So as we begin to wrap up, I want to ask you one more question about Indiana as a diverse community. And in particular, from your vantage point as a diverse executive in, again, Indiana as one of Indiana's largest sports organizations, what do you believe is one of the greatest advances that Indiana companies have made as a collective around, you know, making a more inclusive corporate workspace, corporate community at all levels of Hoosier businesses, most of which still are not diverse or certainly as diverse as we would like them to be? And what would you offer as 2 to 3 tools or tips or resources to any Indiana corporate leader who is still really serious and dedicated to making change within their work environment that does offer a more inclusive and equitable environment where people, all people, do feel like they can not just belong, but advance and be successful in whatever capacity they desire?
One of the things that we think about Hoosier businesses that are doing well is, one, taking the time to understand the value that DEIB brings into the workplace and to their organization as a whole and how they benefit from it. Now, on the flip side of that, you understand the value and you have to put the resources, you have to position people to be able to not only do the work, but to carry it out in a way that it needs to be. And I recognize that sometimes that takes time to do that, but it's important for that to be done. And it's not just, again, something that the diversity office or the inclusion space should be doing, but how does it impact the whole company? Because there is an impact. If we take steps back and look, there really is an impact in multiple areas of an organization when it comes to DEIB. And so I would say for companies, executives to really look at that, but then also to make sure you're continuously listening to what your staff, your colleagues, your leaders are saying that they need to be successful, to feel like that they can be their authentic selves in the work. Because when they're their authentic selves in the workplace and they have the resources, they're going to be able to work harder. They're going to be able to take the company further. So again, paying attention, listening, and then putting in the resources, be it with people power, financial power, to be able to move efforts for your company in the DEIB space further.
Dr. Hackworth, it has been a pleasure to speak with you today. Thank you for coming by the Freedom Forum and sharing your insights about not just what's happening in the NCAA, but what we can look forward to in the future. We so appreciate you being here.
Thanks again for the opportunity. It's been a pleasure. It's been a joy.
Thank you again to Dr. Nya Blair Hackworth, and thanks to you for joining us on this 33rd episode of IBJ's The Freedom Forum with Angela B. Freeman. Please come back next month for another conversation about diversity, equity, and inclusion in the Central Indiana business community.